I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here on this cloudy afternoon for Leonard Lopate. Paul Schaefer has been a fixture in America's living rooms since he began playing piano on Saturday Night Live as a member of the original house band in the 1970s. And since 1982, he's been on every weeknight as band leader for The Late Show with David Letterman. He's jammed with Bob Dylan, Tina Turner, George Harrison, and Mick Jagger, to name just a couple. And his new memoir, Will Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives, written with David Ritz. And in it, Paul Schaefer describes how he made it from playing Mozart in his Schulz Auditorium in Thunder Bay, Canada, to TV and Broadway. The book is published by Doubleday, and I'm so glad it brings him to the show. Welcome.
Boy, Julie, thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here with you.
It's lovely to have you here. Now, tell us a little bit about this wonderful title, We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives. Where did that come from?
Well, I explained it in the first story in the book. I was right out of college, about 21 years old, in Toronto, Canada, taking a year off from my studies to try show business. If it didn't work out, I promised my dad I'd go back to school. And here I am. I've made it. You know, I'm playing on Yonge Street in a seedy topless lounge.
And your father, I bet, thought you made it at that
point,
too,
you know,
or was he a little less
sure?
Listen,
he was giving me the benefit of the doubt and giving me the year, but, you know, it didn't look good at this point for my prospects, and I'm in, all my friends came down to see me. It was like their excuse to, you know, to attend a topless lounge, and there I am, their front row center.
I'm not going to see the girls. I'm going to see Paul.
Me, yeah. I had no idea they were so interested in my music, but there they all are, and as exciting as it was to be working with these semi-clothed performers, it was also a little embarrassing, too, you know, and the girls were not, you know, exactly top-notch Las Vegas quality pageant quality, as Tina Fey says about Sarah Palin. They weren't pageant quality. So I'm like, playing to my friends and saying, the lovely and talented ladies, please show your love. And, you know, and you look up and you see that. And that, by the end of the night, I'm exhausted, embarrassed. And I said, please, you know, you've been a great audience. Come back and see us. We'll be here for the rest of our lives, because that's really the way it felt at the time. Well, luckily, my prospects changed.
Your taste of what showbiz could bring, though, started much earlier than that. I loved the story at the beginning that I mentioned in the introduction about a sort of playoff with your rival when you were about 13 years old, right on the auditorium stage.
I learned competition and show business. You know, I'm like before 13, before my bar mitzvah, but at our little synagogue up in Canada, Northern Ontario, there's only one, and it was an Orthodox synagogue, too, real old-fashioned, old school.
Wow.
But they would have, you know, performing nights, talent nights, and all the kids would play, and I'd play my little piano piece by Mozart or something, and here comes Marvin Slabotsky, you know, a kid just as scrawny and skinny as I was, but about a year older, with a much better ear for music than I had, and I, you know, I prided myself on my ear, and he would rip into jealousy. I don't know how he did it at 12 years old, you know. But here I am at 11. Nobody cared until I'm watching the Ed Sullivan Show with my family, and I saw the piano team of Ferranti and Teicher playing the theme from Exodus. Well, this was biblical. This was solemn. It was schmaltzy. It had everything that Jews love. And I said, if I could just learn that song, you know, which I did. And the next Tuesday at talent night, you know, I put Marvin Slabotsky away with Exodus. And, the old lady, Jewish ladies are saying, oh, Paul Schaefer. He saw, and I said, Mrs. Helper, you're not from Long Island. You know, it's Canada. Nonetheless, it showed me at an early age that if you play the right song for the right crowd, you know, you can score.
I also found it interesting in that here you were. It sounds like you had classical training.
Yes,
that you had
correct.
Learned how to play that way. But what happened was you watched TV and then you picked it up by ear. Was that something you'd been doing since you were a little kid, is hearing things and just playing them?
You know, when I had my first piano lesson, I came home from the lesson and started picking out tunes by ear. And my first song I picked out was the William Tell Overture. And I found that you could play it all almost on the black keys. So that helped. And I don't know what it was, but I just was attracted to, and I found that I could hear melodies. And then when I heard rock and roll, forget it, it was over. That's what I wanted to do, was play rock. And I started to learn chords, just like you would on a guitar. When you play a guitar by ear, I played piano that way. I learned chords, I learned three of them. I could play every rock song that was out at the time.
Did you find learning that way helps you now when someone comes in and you can just say, all right, this is how it's going to go? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I still play by ear. I guess the classical piano teachers were right when they said if you play by ear, you may not learn how to sight read. And I didn't. You know, I faked the sight reading part. I would fake it and learn it by rote and play it by ear. And it's true. My sight reading still isn't up to snuff. And sometimes in a professional situation, I'm up against the wall with that. And I say, oh, can you give me a couple minutes and I'll woodshed this. But normally, I work with my ear. And I just think that, I remember when we did the Blues Brothers with the John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd back in the 70s. And we had a group of very authentic musicians backing them. And one of them was Donald Duck Dunn, the bassist of Booker T and the MGs. And, you know, so I had Southerners in the rhythm section and yet Juilliard students in the horn section. And there was always this clash. The Juilliard students would say, where's the music? You know, and Duck Dunn would say, music! Are you kidding? And he said, if Elvis had come on Ed Sullivan's show and his band had been reading music, there wouldn't have been no rock and roll. And I feel that way, too. Rock and roll should be played from the heart.
Well, that's, you know, you bring up an interesting collision there. And I was wondering, as a band leader, as someone who pulls these groups together, mm-hmm. how do you negotiate that difference between the Juilliard students who are used to having everything on a music stand and the guys like this who say, what do you mean?
There's always a problem. And I'm always in a situation like that where I have players from mixed backgrounds. Even my own band on the Letterman Show, the three horn players, each of them is from a different scene. I've got one trained musician, Tom Malone, who used to arrange for Gil Evans. I've got a guy, a trumpet player, Al Ches, whose background is like military drum corps, drum and bugle corps. And then I've got a sax player from the club scene in New Jersey who knows every song that I know. You know, so they're all there for a reason. But, man, you try to put them together, and if it's right, it's magic. And if it's wrong, it's like, you know, they're not talking to each other.
Do you find part of your role is kind of soothing the fights that happen between these guys?
Oh, of course it is. Of course it is. And that's why, you know, that sociology degree that I got from University of Toronto actually comes in handy. You have to be able to deal with people. As a band leader, a lot of it is dealing with people.
I'm speaking with Paul Schaefer. He is, as you probably know, the band leader for Late Night with David Letterman, and he is also the author of We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives. It's from Doubleday. You talk about that year after college where your dad wanted you to go into the family business, which was law.
Yeah.
And you said, Dad, I would like to try something else. What was that like when you actually said to him, I think I've got something else going on here, and can I try it out?
The funny thing about my parents were that they were of just as dual mindset as I. They wanted me to have a real profession, yet they too loved show business and loved music and wanted their kid, you know, like every Jewish kid, I guess, but with me it seemed even more so. You'll practice, you'll play the piano, and you'll practice. You'll thank me later. And I do. I do thank them later.
I wondered about that. As I read about your childhood, I was wondering, are you this kind of kid who was like, okay, I'm going to go play the piano? Or did you say, I want to go play baseball or hockey
or
whatever? Well, of course.
Who didn't? Everybody did. But I would say, all right, I'll practice my lesson. Then I'd just sit down and bash out the hits by the Four Seasons. Dawn, Go Away, Big Girls Don't Cry, Sherry Baby.
I have quite a picture of you at, you know, whatever age it was, playing all of those things.
Instead of my lesson, you know. And that's how I put in the hours, but I put them in developing my ear. And whatever the original question was,
I don't even remember.
It's long gone.
But it was really about when your parents, who probably like many Jewish parents everywhere, want their child to have a profession. When you said,
"Yes,
I think my profession is not going to be law."
Right,
Dad.
I said, "Dad, I was very conservative too." So I said, "Just give me a year and let me try it and see what happens." And he said, "You know, this isn't a surprise. Your mother and I sort of thought you would be saying that." And I think secretly they were a little bit thrilled that I was going to give it a try. Although my mother admitted that my dad always thought I'd end up like playing at a piano bar at a summer resort.
Or the job that you first had playing in the topless bar, although that probably wasn't
you
what
know
he
what,
hoped for you.
What would be so wrong with that?
Nothing. It could be a lot of fun.
I could go back to those bars at a second and still play the same repertoire, and I'd be perfectly happy. And I think that's the thing about me that has saved me. Whatever it is, I love to play the piano, no matter where it is. And I guess when I said we'll be here for the rest of our lives, I indicate that I could just as well be, you know, tomorrow I could play for an acrobat or a stripper. You know, you just never know what the kind of job I have.
That pleasure in playing must serve you well in all of the different guises that you know, you've arranged records, you've played on shows, you've played on television shows. Is there anything that you've run into that you found that you were losing that pleasure in playing?
You know, I've always had it. Even as a kid, I remember I used to play ballet classes just for the experience. You know, something in me knew, let me get the experience. And there's fun in every music. Every music is great. I think Ray Charles said that. Every music has its own thing, and you shouldn't try to hip it up and change the style of it. Play each kind of music with the credibility that it deserves. That's what I'm trying to do.
You talk in your book about, in a sense, having all of these different people like Ray Charles as your teachers.
Yeah.
And so when did you first get introduced to the music of Ray Charles, and how did you start playing that kind of music yourself?
Somehow, you know, my dad, as a conservative lawyer in Canada, had very hip taste in jazz and music. He loved the great jazz vocalists. He turned me on to Sarah Vaughan. You know, he loved Billy Eckstein. He loved Ray Charles, the genius. He said, this guy is a genius. Listen to this. And it seeped in, you know. I realized that is the man with the soul. And then cut to 76 or so, and there I am on the stage of Saturday Night Live playing with Ray Charles. And this is in the book, too. And it was just amazing because I had the opportunity to play organ, soul organ, behind the genius as he sang, "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning." And I'm supposed to back him up with soul licks, and I was nervous as all get out. I couldn't play. And Ray Charles stopped the whole band in the rehearsal, stopped the band. He said, "Organ, play it with some soul." And oh, I almost died. I didn't know what to do. You know, I got soul. I'm from Canada.
Maybe cold.
But I couldn't, you know, and luckily, my dear friend, who's still a great friend till today, Howard Johnson, who was on tuba and baritone sax in that Saturday Night Live house band, he piped up for me, and he said, "Ray, count it off again. He's got it." And I guess, you know, he heard in Howard's voice something that, I'm not sure, but all Ray did was count it off again, give me another chance. And this time I summed up those memories of my dad and those Ray Charles albums, and I did my best, and I heard Ray Charles say, "Yeah, man, that's better. That's more like it." And boy, I felt so good. I felt so good. But yeah, you know, I've learned from everybody, and I keep on learning. I learned just yesterday. We played a song with the great band called Weezer on the Letterman Show, and they combined their band with our band. And, you know, every time you do something like that, you learn a little more.
I didn't get to see it. That must have been fun. What did you do?
Fun. They've got a new song out, "I'm Your Daddy." And we played with them, you know, and we have learned over the years to be able to compliment a band like that. Maybe, you know, hopefully not take away from what they're doing, but add to what they're doing. One of the tricks is let their drummer play. Don't try to have two drums playing. You know, my drummer played percussion, the hand clap sound, certain electronics, the cowbell and stuff like that. And, you know, that's the first thing. Usually don't try for two basses either, but this one had like a fuzz bass and a clean bass, so I could have both. But I'm getting a little technical here.
No, but that's interesting that the drummer really is the one who leads whatever's going
to
happen.
And, yeah, and if you try to have two drums, then you've got two snares coming down on the backbeats, but up, instead of
and if they're not exactly right.
That's
right.
What they call flamming, and in a bad way, yeah. So the best thing is just to have one drummer play.
You talked a little bit about not learning how to sight read, but one of your big breaks was going in, I guess you probably prepared, with two women singers to try out for Godspell. Had you rehearsed that up in Canada?
It was the Toronto company of Godspell. So
it had been out and you knew the music a little bit.
Well, one girl got the cast album and she was going to sing a song, bless the Lord, from the show, like a show-stopping number. And we learned it together. She learned the vocal. I learned how to play the piano. So, yes, I was prepared. And I went in there with her, and then another girl, friend of mine, was going to sing "I Only Want to Be With You" by Dusty Springfield. Of course, I knew that one. So I went in, and I played these two songs, and it gave Steve Schwartz, the composer, who was in town casting, gave him the opportunity to hear me and to hear me play one of his songs, and somehow he liked it. I think it was just kismet. You know, I was a rock and roll player. This was a rock and roll score at the beginning of the era of rock musicals. And he said to me, normally I get theatrical piano players who can play with a flourish, but not the guys who can hit the keys like a percussive instrument, and you can do that.
Well, it is a percussion instrument, although we forget that. That's how the strings are
played. Exactly right. Hammers hit the strings.
Right.
And he hired me on the spot at the end of the rehearsal. At first, he said, could you play the rest of the rehearsal? And, you know, with my sight reading thing, I said, yeah, I will. Luckily, people were coming up with pop tunes and stuff that I could play by ear, like The Age of Aquarius. You know, if you don't know that, you know, get out of the show business. I knew that, and I remember a guy who sang Heart of Gold by Neil Young. Heart of Gold.
Oh, I remember that one.
I'm
yes.
in a Hollywood. And I knew all those songs, so I was able to hang for the rest of the audition process, and then I got that gig.
We need to go to a break in a minute, but I wanted to ask you about that show. That's where you met a lot of people who've remained friends for the rest of your life. It's sort of a Canadian mafia.
It was. It's getting funny now because I'm going on a lot of shows and just listing the people. And it's like Marty Short, who was one of the people and you know still a great friend, says, it's like you're listing the new faces of 1935. You know? And then there was a boy who turned out to be Dan Daly, you know. But it was Marty Short and Eugene Levy and Dave Thomas and Andrea Martin and Victor Garber and Gilda Radner, all these marvelously talented and funny people, all in that show, 72, Toronto Company of Godspell. They all happen to be there at the same time. They've all gone on to great success and providing a lot of entertainment for all of us through the years.
That must have been a lot of fun.
My goodness, we hung out incessantly, and we talked about the show incessantly. We were all having so much fun.
And your mom and dad got to come and say, okay, Paul, you can go in this direction.
Well, I was making $425 a week, you know, and that was big money for them. And they said, gee, I guess you could. Yeah, that's right. And they sanctioned it, and now I was in show business.
I'm speaking with Paul Schaefer about his memoir, We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives, A Swingin' Showbiz Saga. It's published by Flying Dolphin Press, an imprint of Doubleday. We'll be back with more after a break. It's raining men. Hallelujah, it's raining men. Amen. I'm gonna go out. I'm gonna let myself get absolutely soaking wet. It's raining men. Hallelujah, it's raining men. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here on this afternoon where it's not raining men, unfortunately, it's raining rain outside. But I am here with Paul Schaefer, who wrote that song.
And thank you, Julie.
I have to say, Paul, you also have written a book, Now We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives, from Scribner. And I want from Doubleday. And
Double
I
Day,
wanted,
right.
Sorry, I had the wrong thing in here.
Flying Dolphin, a division of Random House.
A division, yes. Yeah. But I was Googling you earlier this week with my kids around me, and they don't get to stay up late enough to see the show. But as soon as I saw that you had done, I started playing It's Raining Men, and they said, oh, that's Homer Simpson's favorite show.
Isn't that crazy?
They were
or
so excited.
His favorite song, yeah.
Favorite song, that's right. That's his favorite song. Did you have a hand in Homer Simpson liking that song?
No,
or did
I
they...
think it's great. I consider it an homage, though.
Yes.
Thank you, and I thank Homer and all the animated characters, really, of the world for their interest. And that nutty song, It's Raining Men, which I co-wrote. Well, I didn't write the lyrics. I wrote the melody to the lyrics, and the lyrics were by Paul Jabara, the great songwriter in the 70s, from the 70s, unfortunately no longer with us. But he won an Oscar for writing Last Dance for Donna Summer. And called me up after that. I had done some arranging for him in the early 70s, early disco stuff. He had a song called One Man Ain't Enough that he was going to put across with him as the vocalist. That one didn't quite click, but he called me up and he said, you did such a great job in One Man Ain't Enough as an arranger. I'd like you to write this next one for me.
And had you written songs before? Is this something that you had been doing?
I had written comedy songs primarily. I wrote a song for the National Lampoon in 74, an album called Goodbye Pop, sort of a commenting on pop culture. And we had a song on there called Kung Fu Christmas, which was Kung Fu was so big in the rhythm and blues world at that time in the early 70s with Kung Fu fighting. And we thought, what if a group like the Stylistics or the Spinners did a Christmas song? I think it might sound something like this. And it was Kung Fu Christmas with all the rhythm and blues and Superfly imagery in the middle of a Christmas song. Diamond in the back, trimmed with holly, those kind of type of images. That was the kind of writing I had done. But Paul had a funny sense of humor, and he said, I got a song at a title that's going to bring Donna Summer's career back. She'd cooled off a little bit after Last Dance.
But she didn't want to sing it when you finally put it together.
Apparently, you know, as good as the song was and as funny as it was, and that's why I was perfect for Paul to write the melody, because I had a sense of humor, too. And It's Raining Men was just fun, you know. But Donna Summer, in her new role as Born Again Diva, Born Again Diva, you know, had found true enlightenment and didn't see the humor anymore in lines like, "Hallelujah, It's Raining Men, Amen." And she sent her friend Paul Jabara a Bible the next day. Said, "Paul,
oh my goodness,
we've lost you. You know, you're going to the devil. Please, please read this." Needless to say, she didn't want to do the song. And everybody else, all the divas that Paul knew, Streisand he knew, because he wrote Enough is Enough. And the main event, Diana Ross he knew, all of these people. They none of them wanted to do the song.
Well, we played that song, and it's fitting to play that when we're leading into you. But one of the things that I've seen on the show, on the Late Show that you do, is you pay particular attention to the songs that you play to lead in the various people who come on the show. And often they're in jokes that the audience sometimes gets, and sometimes even the performers don't quite get them. Oh. That must be a lot of fun to choose those.
It keeps us going, and you know, gives us a little bit of a jolt to do it every day. We only have about 15 minutes to figure out what we're going to play for each person.
Only 15
minutes?
Yeah,
but then again, we don't need to play full songs. We only need to play four or five bars of this and that, you know. So I just sort of throw it open to the floor, and the floor is like my musicians in the rehearsal. Anybody got something funny for this next guest? And whatever, you know, I pick the funniest one. Sometimes I have an idea. Sometimes it's...
And is this before the show goes on, or is this as it's going?
No, before the show goes on, during my little 15-minute rehearsal. But if I get a better idea during the show, I will say to the band, let's do this instead. And they'll say, what is it? You know, well, here are the chords. And I have a little secret microphone that I can talk to the musicians. Nobody else hears it. And I will sometimes call the chords. Two bars of C, major seventh. While David is talking, here we got a top ten to a listener, and I'm saying a four bars of five, F major. Paul, what are you doing over there? You look like you're doing your own show for Canadian television. No, Dave, I'm just getting this show together.
That is so funny, and that I saw you as we played just the little promos between our conversation. You were conducting what was going on the promos, and it's almost as if you have two pieces of your brain, one working on the words and one working on the music all at the same time.
I certainly can't relax when I'm listening to music. Sometimes, you know, I do take yoga once a week, and the yoga instructors will say, let me put on some soothing music. I say, it's not going to soothe me. I will concentrate on it and start analyzing it and wondering why I can't do that. Take the music off. So if there is music there, I'm listening to it. I'm focusing in on it, for sure.
You also just mentioned that Dave will say, what are you doing over there?
Yeah. And,
in watching the show, you play a number of roles. But in addition to leading the band and saying, okay, two bars of C, two bars.
Yes.
You really play a very particular role with Dave.
Mm-hmm.
And in watching, and friends have said this too, it's almost as if you can say things that nobody else can.
Oh, that's interesting. I hope that's the case. I sometimes have gotten a little outrageous, and sometimes have gone over the line. But I find that my role is usually pull him back, you know, play the devil's advocate, but not the devil necessarily. You know, sometimes if he gets a little too mean, I'll say, David, you know.
Well,
Mayor Bloomberg is a very nice gentleman. You know, it's not nice to say, you know, do those short jokes all the time. And that's become my function.
Well, that, you know, when I was saying that, that's what I meant, is that not you say outrageous things, but almost to Dave, you can say things that if anybody else said them, there might be trouble.
God love him. He has said to me, Paul, say anything you want. How many bosses would say that? And if I get out of line, people will say, you know, did he talk to you afterwards? No. He'll talk to me right on the air. He'll say, Paul, why did you, you know? And the only time I get a note from him is right on television, which is, talk about reality TV. I think we are truly reality TV. He'll give me my notes right on the air.
I'm talking to Paul Schaefer, who is the band leader for The Late Show with David Letterman and the author of We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives by Doubleday.
Yeah.
In that role, do you ever find yourself put in a position of saying some things that you'd rather not have to say?
Oh, not necessarily that I'd rather not have to say, but sometimes that I wish that I hadn't said.
Mm.
That will often come up. I'm reminded of that story that is in the book, by the way, Doubleday, We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives, but we're not here to plug it. But
no, not at all. But we're still having a good time.
But there was that time when Julia Roberts came on.
Yes.
And she had just broken up with a serious boyfriend, and Dave was saying to me at the beginning of the show, Paul, I don't know what to do. You know, should I ask her about it? Is she dating him? Is she dating anybody new? He said, why don't you ask her? So I said, all right. And then I had the whole show to figure out what I was going to say to her. Is she single? Is she, you know, how am I going to put it? And when it finally came time, she said, Paul, I believe you have a question for me. And I said, yes, Julia, I do. Are you getting laid these days? And I'm telling you, the house fell down. Nobody was expecting it.
Yes.
And Dave came over. He was almost going to physically discipline me. She had to hold his arms back. It was all in fun.
And she was shaking her finger at you.
Yeah,
yes.
It was all in fun, of course. And then during the commercial, she placed a beautiful kiss on my forehead.
Oh, very
nice. As if
nice.
To say, oh, you're so funny.
All is forgiven.
And they showed it as one of the bumpers coming back. You know, here's what just happened. Her kissing me on my forehead. My friend Eugene Levy from Toronto said, she kissed you like Snow White would kiss one of the seven dwarfs. You know, and I said, from Julia Roberts, it's fine with me.
Well, as I'm sure you know, when you're Googled, that is on YouTube, that is one of the top clips. So anybody who wants to see that can probably
I'm sorry,
go take
I made a
look
fool
if they
of myself,
want to.
But she was very sweet about it.
You have been on the show since 1982.
Since the year Gimmel.
Since the year.
We say, yeah.
Since the year
And they
Gimmel.
Say that up in the ghetto, yeah.
And have you found over these years, I mean, Dave is your boss, but have you become friends? Is this something that is
Definitely.
Also a personal relationship?
Well, you know, we started off as friends, but the friendship really has grown into something real. It's gone the opposite direction of most people that you would think working together so long.
Well, five times a week or four times a week, I guess it's a little
bit. And I think that we have, you know, just the experience of doing it 4 days a week, five shows a
right,
week.
Right, right.
Week in and week out, there's something about, you know, being there to support the guy. And then I guess when we went overseas together, that's the last couple of chapters in the book about how we went right after we declared war in Afghanistan. Dave was there with me Christmas Eve entertaining, and then we entertained Christmas Eve in Iraq the first 2 years we were there. And experiencing that together really did, I think, cement the friendship.
These past few weeks have been in the news for a lot of reasons in terms of the upheaval at the show and the revelation of extortion and things like that. What was that like as someone who works with Dave and is his friend? What did you feel during
all
of that?
I wish, Julie, that I could answer this question. They've told me over at the show, because there is an ongoing legal proceeding, and you referred to it, I guess, I'm not supposed to say anything about it. And I'm kind of, you know, my dad, the lawyer that he was, I remember watching TV with him, and he would say, you see, they can't comment on that because there's an ongoing legal. And this is what it is. So, you know, my dad would be proud of me for giving this legal disclaimer. Not even allowed to refer to it.
As a son of a lawyer, I completely
son of a lawyer.
Understand
yeah, that's
that.
Right.
The show is different when you're not there. I have to say, even though the band is wonderful, there is a sense of connection that you have with Dave, that when you're not there, things are different.
Well, I have developed this relationship with him over the 27. That's a lot of years, you know. It's not easy for somebody to just come in and step into that role. So I don't doubt, you know, that it's a little bit different. But I'll tell you something. I had the opportunity to guest host that show a couple of times when Dave was out.
Oh, wow.
It is so hard when the whole show is on your shoulders. I think my job is so hard. I mean, it's nothing compared to what Dave does. So anything I can do to support him, you know, I'm there for him. And if I'm not there for one night, you know, I'll be back. And it's, you know, not so big a deal. Thanks for saying that, though.
But it's interesting. You know, you already play a couple of roles in that you're leading this band. You're playing the piano. You're having this rapport with Dave. Adding one more thing, which is sitting in his seat, I can imagine the juggle would be even
well,
more
Well, that's
intense.
Where you really learn, you know, how it's all on him. It's all on him. And the guests come out and, you know, the segments live or die depending on how well you do. And it's only an hour, but you'd be surprised that just to concentrate and give it your all, you know, that's the trick of it.
Have you found, because you've done both live, you've done live television for all these years, or live on tape, I guess.
Yeah, and except Saturday Night Live, you know, which I did for the first 5 years as piano player and writer. That was totally live. This is even liver, though, this live on tape, because we are not scripted. Saturday Night Live is sketches that are scripted.
And you'd rehearsed all those sketches, and so you go on and perform.
Yeah, that is, you know, as live as it is not all that spontaneous, except when somebody slips up, and the audience loves that. But our show is totally, is all the way live.
Do you find when you do go to record a record, is it in a sense harder because there's an energy to live that's very different from what goes on when you're actually recording something?
My greatest success, I think, as a musician was the Blues Brothers record, and I put together that band, of course, and was MD on it. Recording it live made all the difference, the liveness of the band and how they react to each other and relate to each other when they know they only got one chance, and the audience's energy, too. There's nothing like it. It's true. I've gotten used to it, maybe spoiled by it.
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's a particular kind of challenge, but it also gives you something. And having the audience there, too, I can imagine. Having the studio audience there every night must really be a kick.
You know, on Letterman, it strikes me, because I did an interview in honor of my book with him. He interviewed me. It was terrific. And he made it so comfortable for me. I can do things. I think that's the reason why I could say things on that show that maybe nobody else could say or whatever. He makes it very comfortable for me, even though my job is supposed to be making it comfortable for him. There's nothing like working with him. I feel that I have the freedom to be funnier on that show than anywhere else.
And you've had a chance to be funny in a lot of different places.
Thank
you.
So that's
very nice to hear.
Thank you, Julie. And I'm trying to be funny on this show.
Let's see. It's a different role. I guess you can't tease me the way that you tease him. So
I don't know much about you.
That's right. Next time you're on the show.
All right. Yeah, I'll Google you with my kids.
Yeah, I don't think they'll be quite as impressed as my kids were about you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm speaking with Paul Schaefer about his memoir, We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives, A Swinging Showbiz Saga. It's published by Flying Dolphin Press, an imprint of Doubleday. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Boy, it's been a pleasure being here. This is a big show to do and a big network, and I'm very happy that you asked me to be on.
Well, we're delighted you were
here. Thank you very much, Julie.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.